There we go. Thanks. That's good. Yeah. Everyone hear me okay? So, again, my name is Andrew, and some of you may not know our spiritual leader is Lama Yeshe Jinpa, and I'm filling in for him today because he is currently in France. I think Paris, right? Yeah. You know, it must be nice for him, right? Being in Paris. Jeez, I mean, wish I were there. You know, I mean, he gets to have this great time. In fact, people even help donate to his vacation, and no one donates to my vacation. I can't remember the last time I had a two-week vacation. Well, I haven't been on retreat either for a long time. You know, and then who does he leave in charge? Who does he tell people to come talk to? Geshe Damcho and Susan. Here I am doing the talk. He doesn't elevate me to a leadership position, right? I mean, the nerve, right? Anyway, you know, whatever. Let's go ahead with my talk, okay? I'm doing a series of talks on the kleshas. The kleshas, as Lama Jinpa defines, are emotions that cause conflict. And throughout this series that I'm going to be doing, I'm going to be focusing on various emotions. And Lamala asked me to talk about a particular emotion today. So those of you who didn't see the website, can you guess what emotion I'm talking about today?
Envy.
Envy, yes. So that was my acting job, okay? I'm really actually having vicarious joy that Lama is, I just think of him there and it brings me such happiness. It's just so wonderful to think of him traipsing through Paris with baguette in his hand and, you know. Yes, Beret and Sabrina too. This is their deferred honeymoon. So it's awesome, so awesome. What's that?
It's a little baguette.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I brought up Sangha envy, you know. I don't feel that way about you, Susan. I brought up Sangha envy on purpose because Lamala says that Sangha is one of the main places that envy tends to manifest itself for us. So we may subtly or not so subtly find ourselves in competition with each other for various things like Lamala's attention, higher levels of responsibility, more Dharma friends, things like that. So we tend to express our envy to those who are closest to us. So he wanted me to talk about envy, and particularly Sangha envy. So my sources for this talk are including Darshan sessions with Lamala and writings from Drupan Thinli Nyingpo, if I'm pronouncing that right. The Hidden Brain podcast, has anyone ever listened to that? Yeah. Kenshin Throngpo Rinpoche and Alexander Berzin. So try not to read too much, but I'm very envious of Mike over here because he just talks it out. Like I wish I could do that. So that's a manifestation of my Sangha envy is that I have a hard time not reading. So the kleshas arise from the three poisons, which are attachment, aversion, and ignorance. And actually, the three poisons are a condensed version of what's known as the five poisons. What are the other two? Pride and envy. Okay. So pride is a combination of ignorance and attachment, and envy is a combination of attachment and aggression. Did you hear some aggression when I was talking earlier? The Sanskrit and Tibetan define this klesha with one word, which is usually translated as jealousy. The Sanskrit word is irshya, and the Tibetan word is so awesome, frag dog. I just love that. Like, and it's also PH, frag, you know. So, and in English, the klesha is usually separated into jealousy and envy. And so sometimes people have a hard time, what is jealousy versus envy, right? So I looked up the definitions, and jealousy is, in English is usually defined as more a reaction to losing, the threat of losing something, or more usually someone. And envy is a reaction to lacking something that someone else has. So that's a nice little distinction to think about. So when Lama asked me to talk about envy, I was like, really? I didn't really relate to envy when he first brought it up. I couldn't really imagine that I could really relate to the topic. But then I started thinking about it, and I was like, oh my God, I'm like envious all the time. You know, like every day that I go to work, I'm envious of the cat laying on the bed, sunning themselves, right? Or, you know, actually, I think about an example, like I use the mic envy. Something I've kind of thought about at various points in my life, and I'm definitely not as bad with it now as I used to be, but as men, there's something called alpha male, right? So the alpha male is the traditionally considered like tall, which I'm not, full head of hair, which I don't have, masculine, which I'm not very, right? Deep booming voice, which I don't have. So I don't really measure up, right? So I can see other people that have what I don't have, and it used to bother me more than I think I've probably still does a little bit, but mostly I think I'm over that at this stage. So I don't know if I'm unique in my, you know, that outward ignorance of my envy, or if it's more universal to have this little or no felt sense of one's envy. You know, that it takes real exploration to find it in oneself. I don't know. I think it's pretty subtle most of the time for us. It's kind of operating on this unconscious level. So let's talk about, you know, what did the Buddhist texts talk about in terms of envy? So they classify it as a part of hostility. They define it as a disturbing emotion that focuses on other people's accomplishments, such as their good qualities, possessions, or success, and is the inability to accept their accomplishments due to being too attached to your own gain or to how much respect you receive. So this is from the Hidden Brain podcast. There's a really good talk on envy in that one. Anthropologists have noted that every social group, even in the animal realm, has inequality in hierarchies. Primates are highly aware of their position within the hierarchy and spend a higher amount of time looking at the alpha animal. And this sows the seeds for envy. We humans make sense of the world through social comparisons. We compare ourselves to others that we meet, and from how they seem in relation to us, how much taller or shorter are they than I am, older or younger, etc. This tells us where we fit within the human hierarchy. When we view that others are higher than us on the hierarchy, we are inclined to feel envious. This may be benign and may be motivational from a relative sense. For example, I want to be more like Mike and be able to just give my talk without looking at my notes, or like Susan, who reads more than I do or volunteers more than I do. That's benign envy. And this might inspire us to work harder. Benign envy might manifest as admiration. The problem is, when we begin to do too much social comparison, it inevitably causes unhappiness. There's some interesting studies on users of social media that the amount of time they spend on it, their happiness goes like this. So why do you think that is? What does that have to do with envy? Yeah.
Ever turn out the way that you think they're going to turn out, you know?
Yeah, that's a great example. So I think, you know, like the social media sites like Facebook or Instagram, people are posting pictures of their vacations, right? Well, if the Lama posts a picture of France, I might get kind of envious, right? Because I'm wondering why I don't get to do that, right? I mean, not with Lama, of course, but... Or, you know, someone else's kid wins the athletic championship, and why isn't my kid more athletic? Or, so people are negatively comparing, right? And social media is so much about posting. Very rarely do people post their vulnerabilities. It's always their accomplishments. And, so people are constantly comparing themselves to others and finding themselves lacking. And it's interesting. My daughter Zoe taught me the teenage rules for Instagram. So I took a picture. We were like having lunch together, and I took a picture, and I thought it was really cute. She's smiling and laughing. And I said, oh, you just innocently, you should post that on Instagram. She said, Dad, I could never post that picture. And I said, why not? She said, I'm not cute enough in it. And she explained to me that you only post really, really good pictures of yourself, because if you don't get enough likes, you're going to feel really bad about yourself. And then she showed me a picture she'd posted, and all the comments were these other kids telling her how good she looked. Right? That was, there were no comments about like, oh, it looks like you're having a good time. It was, you look hot, you look cute. And so it's all about that social comparison reflection thing. And so that's, you know, so that's, I think social media is a great example of where we do that social comparison. So seeing that others have what you don't have doesn't just produce feelings of envy, but of anger and resentment. And this is known as hostile envy. The more hostile forms of envy, as opposed to benign envy, more have to do with leveling the playing field. Not by bringing me up to where you are, but by bringing you down to where I am. Social psychologists demonstrate that the most virulent forms of envy are reserved for those who are closest to us on the social hierarchy, interestingly enough. So that's our neighbors, our coworkers, even our fellow Sangha. It's easy for this kind of envy to lead to Schadenfreude. I think that's such a cool word. It's obviously German. So Schadenfreude is taking pleasure in other people's failure or downfall. Or something bad happening to them. So this is Schadenfreude is something that we typically hide away. There are a few situations in which it's deemed socially okay to air one's Schadenfreude. Politics and sports, right? We can root for our team to win and the other team to lose and be happy when the other team loses, right? Or when the political opponents, you know, political party's opponent loses, we can get happy, right? So I do struggle, because I'll admit to Schadenfreude, you know, I can take pleasure in seeing someone who's a hypocrite fail, right? To be brought down, like you were talking Pinterest. Who's the queen of the having everything put together really well? Martha Stewart, right? And what happened to her?
Prison.
Right. Did anyone see any, did anyone have any little piece of pleasure for that? Right, that's Schadenfreude. So, but you know, this is almost a universal thing, right? For some reason, we just do this. We humans, we take pleasure, we tend to get pleasure when people who are too high on the social hierarchy get taken down a peg. We could see that they're too greedy, too rich, too nice, too smart, too pretty, too successful. Like, think about how, like, in your workplace, maybe your boss gets gossiped about, right? So the higher you are, the more likely someone's going to be trying to pull you down on some level. We want that to be even. We always want everything to be even. There's the hierarchy, but we don't want it. So, again, when others are doing better than we are, our instinct is to pull them down to where we are. And when we do that, it feels good.
Which is just perceived. I mean, because like where we are is like, that's so subjective that it doesn't really mean anything.
Right. And it's part of our suffering, right? So this is why it's one of the poisons, and we'll get to that some more.
Okay.
So dukkha is commonly translated as pain or suffering or dissatisfaction. It's the first noble truth. The key to dukkha is wanting what we don't have and not wanting what we do have. So I think that pretty clearly describes envy, right? So Trungpa Rinpoche said that envy is the disturbing emotion that drives us to become highly competitive and to work fanatically to outdo others or ourselves. It is connected to forceful action. It is in the karma family of the five Buddha families, which I'll discuss in a little bit. So Buddhism uses the horse to represent envy. It races against other horses because of envy. It cannot bear that another horse is running faster. So our competitiveness drives others to compete with us as they fall behind on the social hierarchy. And so it just keeps going on and on, right? Got to be first. And I think especially in America, we have this capitalist society that's all about competition. Survival of the fittest. So I think it can be really challenging to us to think about some of these Buddhist concepts like accepting defeat and offering victory to others, because that's not how we're trained to be in our society. And so, you know, we can see that in our politics, right? It's about our candidates build themselves up and tear the other person down. And I think we're really in a bad cycle right now of a lot of people building themselves up and tearing other people down. So it's a particularly afflictive time for us. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of interesting. It's really a culturally relative thing that we, I think, suffer in the West, because Alexander Berzin was writing that we Westerners may need to see our way of doing things as culturally relative. And he gave an example of, who's been to India? I know you have, Mike. Anybody else? You see the small open-air markets they have in India. So he described that, you know, there's cloth markets, jewelry markets, vegetable markets, and so on. And each has row after row of stalls and shops right next to each other, all selling almost exactly the same goods. So most of the shopkeepers are friends with each other and often sit drinking tea together outside the shops. And their attitude is it's up to their karma whether or not their shops do well. Right? So different. So let's talk about what Buddhism gives us to help us with our envy. So earlier we were talking about the five poisons. The five poisons in Vajrayana are also talked about in the context of the five Buddha families. So this is from Kenshin Throngpa Rinpoche. The essential nature of a bodhisattva or a Buddha is that he or she embraces the enlightened qualities of the five Buddha families, which pervade every living being without exception, including ourselves. To achieve the realization of these five Buddha families, or the five Dhyana Buddhas, it is necessary to abandon the five disturbing emotions of great attachment, anger or aggression, ignorance or bewilderment, pride and envy. When these disturbing emotions are purified and removed, the five wisdoms shine forth. Realization of the five wisdoms is realization of the five Dhyana Buddhas. So, when we purify these five kleshas, we realize the enlightened qualities of the Dhyana Buddhas. Each klesha has a purification. For example, when anger is purified, we develop what's called mirror-like wisdom, where there's no separation between self and other phenomena, so everything's experienced in unity and harmony. It is called mirror-like because phenomena appear to the mind in the same way that things appear in a clean mirror, completely accurate and with no distortion. So as I mentioned before, the poisons of envy, competitiveness, jealousy are taking place in the realm of the karma family. So envy is represented by the Dhyana Buddha Amoghasiddha, who is green in color, which is fitting, right? With envy, we are furthering our own suffering and attachment to a delusional separation of I and other. And it is preventing us from accomplishing wisdom. As long as jealousy determines one's attitude, One is bound to experience more obstacles in achieving personal success and in accomplishing positive goals. This is from Alexander Berzin, by the way. This is why Buddha Amoghasiddha's activity is wrathful. It is with wrath that he removes all obstacles and hindrances preventing spiritual maturation and success. His green color is actually symbolizing growing plants, symbolizing the numerous activities he employs to remove hindrances. His wisdom is an all-accomplishing wisdom. Like a doctor who diagnoses a disease by taking the patient's pulse and then does all he can or she can to treat and remedy the disease, the Buddhas, with their all-accomplishing wisdom, consider beings and the ways by which they might benefit them, and then appear spontaneously and effortlessly without change or exertion to benefit those beings. Lamala says that envy can be purified into admiration. This goes back to the idea of benign envy that we talked about and that can be used to inspire a person. In the karma family, aspiration can be an enlightened activity. We're always using enlightened energy to purify ourselves. For example, we should admire the Buddha and our precious teachers and be inspired by their accomplishments to see that enlightenment is possible and that we can work to benefit all sentient beings the way they have. Instead of wanting to bring a person down to our level, we aspire to raise ourselves up to their level of good qualities. You see the difference, right? So another antidote is to utilize the wealth practices, such as generosity. Lamala says that when we hear of another person's good fortune, our first thought is usually, that's great for you. No, in a good way, that's great for you. Our second thought is, why not me? And he says that we typically just skip right on over our awareness of our first thought. That first thought is otherwise known as sympathetic joy, which is also a practice of generosity. So maybe we need to just cycle back over to, oh yeah, I'm actually happy for this person, right? Sympathetic joy. I think it's just so hard to do, sympathetic joy. Like that's the one that is stuck for me in the Brahmavihara, the four immeasurables, right? It's a mouthful too. May all beings be inseparable from the joyful happiness that's free from suffering, right? Like all the other ones are so easy. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of. And then you get to that third one, it's like, ugh. What does that mean? Joyful happiness is free from suffering. So that's sympathetic joy. And interestingly, there's no word in English for the opposite of envy. Can you think of one? Like the opposite of hate?
Love.
The opposite of sadness? Opposite of envy?
Appreciation.
Humbleness, appreciation. Those kind of get around it.
Gratitude.
What else? Generosity. Okay, these are all great words, but there's not one word that sums all that up. Right? I mean, even sympathetic joy is there is a, I think in Tibetan there is one word, but I don't know what it is. But we don't have that. So I think as Westerners we have a hard time with how do we respond to envy? What's the opposite of that? So I just found that really interesting. So Buddhism ultimately teaches us the underlying fallacy of these concepts of a separate I and other, of a winner and a loser. When we're envious, we tend in that moment to place our whole identity into our deficiency. I'm too thin, or I'm too fat, or I'm too old, or I'm too young. That just becomes everything about us. We just take that, you know, I failed in this moment, therefore I am a failure, right? We tend to do that complete identity thing with how we're not measuring up. So this further reinforces our delusional fixation on a separate and deficient self. I found this quote from a professor of psychology at University of Kentucky named Richard Smith. If you're an envious person, you have a hard time appreciating a lot of the good things that are out there because you're too busy worrying about how they reflect on the self. So everyone has a Buddha nature. No one is different in this regard. Everyone contains the potential for attaining enlightenment, happiness, and freedom. Deep down, what does every human being want? To be happy and to be free from suffering, to have happiness and the causes of happiness, to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, such as failure. None of us is different in this regard. Everyone wants the same thing, and if we truly wish for all sentient beings to be happy, we need to include everyone, not leaving out the ones who are doing better than us, right? This is practicing equanimity. If we want all beings to be happy, we should take joy in their success, because we want everyone to be happy. This is vicarious joy. It's kind of cool, vicarious joy. It feels good to us, and we get to take the win too. Right? So it's changed the way I view sports. Try to find something good about the other team winning, that I don't have to feel so bad if my team loses. Theologian Thomas Aquinas said of envy, "Envy, according to the aspect of its object, is contrary to charity, whence the soul derives its spiritual life. Charity rejoices in our neighbor's good, while envy grieves over it." What's that? Charity? Could be. It's kind of getting to that generosity. Yeah. That's about the closest we found, right? Okay. And for me, it also helps to remember that this other being is a sentient being who's suffering like myself. And if I'm taking it upon myself as a bodhisattva to ease their suffering, why should I begrudge them when their suffering is actually being eased, right? So there's also always, whenever you're struggling, there's so many different possible ways to manage one's kleshas, including envy. This is by no means an exhaustive list that I'm giving you today, so I'd be happy to hear if other people have identified and found things for themselves, but I'll mention a couple of the Lojong slogans as well, because I always like to go back to the Lojong slogans. They're like little recipes, right? Distill little recipes. What do you do? So the 57th one I love, it's so simple. It just says, "Don't be jealous." Duh. But beyond that, you can look at, there's a few more that I pulled out. Number 56, don't wallow in self-pity. So I took some of the commentary from Trungpa Rinpoche on these. He said, don't feel sorry for oneself, because don't waste time feeling bad if somebody else achieves success because it wasn't you. So it's kind of just a waste of time. Number 58 is don't be frivolous. Don't demonstrate frivolous jealousy at your friend's success. So it's seen as frivolous, right? It really is. It's like gossip is frivolous. Number 49, always meditate on what provokes resentment. Always meditate on that which is most difficult. If you do not start right away, the moment difficulty arises, it is very hard to overcome it. Number 38, don't seek others' pain as the limbs of your own happiness. Number 35, don't try to be the fastest. This is that whole kind of racehorse approach to your practice. This is that Sangha envy thing, you know. Who understands the highest meaning of Mahamudra or the greatest meaning of Tantra? Who can sit for the longest? Who can get the most of Lamala's attention? Trungpa Rinpoche said that this turns Dharma practice into a game rather than an actual practice. And there's no seed of benevolence and gentleness in the practitioner, as this is using one's practice as a means of getting ahead of your fellow students. So that's what I've got for you today. I hope that's helpful. I want to hear from you guys. How are you relating to this? What have you found that works for you, or where are you at with this? Yeah. Oh. Yes, Marie. Over here.
Sorry. I found that for me, actually springing from the Lojong Sogwen's, Tonglen really helps.
Okay.
Taking and sending, exchanging oneself for others, because it's a practice that really builds the equanimity you were talking about, where we really are all the same. And so, yeah, it's sort of helping with Schadenfreude. That's a really hard one.
Yeah, that's good, because maybe through that you're potentially sending energy to rise them up out of their negative qualities in some way.
Right, and really coming to an understanding that really we are the same, that the same basic needs, like you said, you know, we don't want to suffer, we want to be happy, and no matter what the disparities are, fundamentally we are all the same. So it's my mind that reacts to all the details.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. Dana, do you want to? Oh, okay.
How do you meditate about resentment?
How does one meditate about resentment? Does anyone have an idea about that before I share what I think?
Rather than thinking the thought, feeling it in the body.
Mm-hmm.
That has worked for me, but I think you're going to be more.
I forgot about that, so thank you. I don't know. I think, yeah, in meditating, thoughts don't feel quite so solid and substantial and real, right? I mean, just in standard practice of anger management, you never want to react in the moment to your anger. What you'll often find is that if you wait a little bit, it dissipates. And in meditation, my gosh, does people experience this? Like, whatever that so solid and fixed thing that you're focused on, it just dissipates so much faster, right? When you don't feed it with discursive thought, right? Like with anger, resentment, I put in the anger realm, right? It's just like, how dare that person? I can't believe they. And it's just circular thinking, and it builds on itself, and it's kind of intoxicating in this weird way. So when we kind of look for the spaces between the thoughts, the emotions just aren't so solid. They just dissipate so much faster. That's one of the things I love about meditation. So, and then I think it kind of generalizes outside of meditation. People experience that, like they're not as reactive. So I think that's how I would take that. But that's just my personal.
You're a little resentment there.
Yeah. Do you resent the fact that I brought up resentment?
That I read somewhere was, if you're resenting that somebody else got something that you wanted, well, you're not going to get it anyway. So it just, I mean, it's like illogical. I think I'm pretty sure it was a Shantideva quote or something, but it's just illogical. If somebody got a job maybe that you wanted, or got the girlfriend or boyfriend that you wanted, The thing is that you're not going to get them anyway. So it's just so totally illogical and such a waste.
Right. And it's again, the opposite of sympathetic joy, right? Wishing others to be happy. So if someone gets something you don't have, can you offer that victory to them in that way and be happy for them? Yeah, loving kindness, metta. Yeah. We're having a hard time with the mic.
Well, I was Nietzsche said that resentment is the sentiment of a slave. So, you know, if you want to think that your resentment is like a, I always found that useful many years ago, but if you think you think your resentment's this powerful thing, you know, what he's saying is look at it and see how much it enslaves you, you know, mm-hmm. really just turns you into a doesn't do you any good.
You're a victim. Hi, I know I'm not part of the Sangha. Thank you for letting me share.
I've had
a profound experience of envy this year. I had a very, very difficult and painful divorce with a lot of loose ends the last 3 years and learned last summer that my ex had a new partner. And I've been telling people if God were to create the cosmic foil to all my insecurities, he would have made this woman. She's extremely beautiful, extremely accomplished, artistic, feminine, spontaneous, very maternal. And not only are they close, but she's become very close to my children, and they admire her. They've taken up certain things that she does. And so I've had a lot of opportunities to investigate envy in myself this year, and I just wanted to share like three ways that I've worked with it. And I don't want to underestimate how, as I say, what I've done to work with it, how intensely I feel this envy, because it really does involve like violent thoughts about her and my husband almost daily, or and my ex-husband. But one thing that's helped is getting really clear that I don't actually know what I'm envious of. I don't know what their situation is, and understand that it is temporary. You know, what flashes to me as being really provoking and intense and solid and real, I realize is in fact just a piece of what's going on and one part of what will, you know, an experience or a relationship or a situation that will evolve and perhaps devolve. I don't know what it is, and the more attached I am to the image of it that is disturbing to me, the less clarity I have about the fact that it will pass, like everything else that I'm attached or unattached to. Mm-hmm. And the next is trying to experience what might be of benefit to me from that very thing that I'm jealous of. So I've tried to tell myself, well, this woman has some qualities that I admire, and she is spending a lot of time with my daughters. So, you know, given the truth that I cannot spend all my time with my children and I need to have time to myself to develop into the person that they can admire and do other things that are fulfilling to me, I can appreciate that, A, that she brings stability to their home with their dad, and that she's introducing them to things that I think are valuable to them. And I had one more thing I wanted to say about it. And then the last is what you said about trying to mine some motivation to change myself. Like when I think about envy about this person's appearance or accomplishment, I can say, well, like what's the heart of that for me is maybe I don't take as good care of myself as I'd like to, and I see this person and I project that you know, she spends a lot of time caring for her health and her body, and instead of directing my energy towards resenting that, where can I turn it inward and take better care of myself? Or if she's accomplished in her career and I feel, you know, lowly and miserable because I was a stay-at-home mom for 10 years and now make $20 an hour as a massage therapist instead of a lawyer, I can say, well, what do I want to do with that? Do I, you know, How can I cultivate a path forward for myself with that, perhaps as a motivation? And So I guess with all of those, like I realize that they're inherently self-centered motivations. They're not. It's not really about like being good or improving my practice. But I think starting where I am with the realization that these are the things that motivate me. This is where I can work right now. Being honest, self-honest about that has really helped me a lot.
Wonderful.
Thank you guys for listening.
There's a word that's a prototype word you might have. You heard of compersion?
Mm-mm.
That might. I read the definition if you like. Maybe it's the one you're looking for. The feeling of joy one has experiencing another's joy, such as in witnessing a toddler's joy and feeling joy in response. Compersion.
So that's interesting. I wonder if that separates out because, you know, I was funny on the way here. I was telling Lily, my other daughter, that, you know, I only feel happy when she succeeds, right? That's parental love, right? That's what we expect. But does it extend to people that succeed that we don't feel close to? Is that definition in there too?
Well, the other part is the feeling of joy associated with seeing a loved one love another contrasted with jealousy. So in some ways, I guess it could be an antonym of jealousy also.
Okay.
The first time I heard it's common in the polyamorous community. They really like that word.
One more time.
Compersion. Compersion.
Is that in the dictionary or the slang dictionary?
Where am I getting this from? Let's see. Wiktionary. I don't know. I'm sure there must be. Yeah.
It's a new kind of
it's a modern word, but you know.
Well, we're searching around for the word to bring it into. Maybe this will become the word. That would be great, right? We need that word in our dictionary. Awesome.
There is a film made, I don't know, 20 years ago called Topsy Turvy about I'm losing the names. famous British musical writers, and one was the lyricist, and one was the something like that. Jim Broadbent was played one of the parts, and there was one scene where they had just had this big smash success, and it was the toast of the town, and he sits down with his wife, and he says, she says, so how are you feeling, dear? He says, oh, well, there's something so very inherently disappointing about success. And and then when I saw Lama, I fortunately got to see him just briefly before he left, asking him about the trip and how I'm so excited for you. And he said, well, yes, it's already happened. And and the idea of basically that the most wonderful part of any experience or having anything is not the thing itself, but it's how I feel about it. And so that I could actually potentially feel and receive any of the blessings and the thrill of anything that anybody had, because the only really tangible, I mean, it's funny to say tangible because I guess it's sustainable, lasting, is the joy, right? And that I could tap into that at any time, even if it wasn't my thing or wasn't my experience. So anyway, that was my thought about envy and flipping it on its head into something that I could actually receive from. You touched upon that at the beginning of your lecture today, but anyway, those were my thoughts about how to release the afflictive feeling of that, you know, and experience actually maybe some joy and on looking at what I didn't have, but what I could have, you know. Anyway,
great, yeah. Well, it seems like I'm not the only one who relates to this topic, so. But yeah, I think that, again, Lama Jinpa's words are sticking with me, you know. How wonderful for you. Why not me? So back it up. Come back to the first, how wonderful for you. Right? We can do that. We can back it up. So, but we, you know, that conscious awareness is important. So again, maybe through meditation, you know, we just get so reactive in our daily lives. So, well, thank you. Let's do closing prayers.